Have you ever loved someone so much that you followed them around and talked endlessly about them to all your friends and family? That's how much we love rhododendron, a quirky and amazing genus of flowering plants with a deep human history and an incredible ecological legacy. Follow along on our adventures as we learn about the remarkable things that folks all around the world have done for the love of rhododendron.
Season 2, Episode 5, Faith in a Seed. In this episode, we meet Emily Ellingson, Plant Collections Curator at Poly Hill Arboretum. We learn how Emily's own career was inspired by Arboretum founder Poly Hill, who held a strong faith in seeds and became an early adopter of electronic plant records. Emily shares the story of Poly's rhododendron and azalea hybrids and highlights the important work taking place now in conservation horticulture, including an excellent internship program, presenting the next generation an opportunity to grow and try out different things, carrying on Poly's legacy, as expressed by Henry David Thoreau, "Convince me that you have a seed there, and I am prepared to expect wonders."
Hi, and welcome to this month's episode of For the Love of Rhododendron. Today I'm here with Juliana, one of our co-hosts, and Emily Ellingson. Emily comes to us from the Poly Hill Arboretum, where she is curator and assistant director. Welcome to Juliana and Emily.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Hi, Emily. We're really excited to have you here and learn about Poly Hill Arboretum.
Yeah, I don't know what it's like for you, but here it is. We are getting all of the signs of winter right now, and it is scaring me because I'm not ready for it.
It is. So because of the moderating effect of the ocean on Martha's Vineyard, so Poly Hill Arboretum is on Martha's Vineyard, we have a pretty extended fall. So it's been like in the 60s and beautiful for the last week. It's been great.
That's interesting to hear, and I think is a great lead off into our first question, which is just about Poly Hill Arboretum. Can you tell us some of the history and when it was founded, who Poly Hill was?
Yeah, definitely. So Poly Hill Arboretum became an arboretum in 1998, but the history actually extends far earlier than that. So in 1926, the Butchers, who were Poly Hill's parents, purchased an old sheep farm in West Tisbury, Massachusetts, which is on the island of Martha's Vineyard. And it became Barnard's Inn Farm is what they called it, and eventually, you know, the Poly Hill Arboretum. So Polly, she spent her summers in college coming to this farm and like removing poison ivy from the stone walls, and doing some kind of horticulture. Her mom planted, would plant things around the grounds. And she spent a year teaching English in Japan, married Julian Hill, who was a DuPont chemist, and eventually they lived in Wilmington, Delaware, where she visited gardens like Longwood and Winterthur. And she spent a lot of, she really got into horticulture in that way of visiting gardens. And eventually traveled back to Japan, and upon the request of Russell Seibert at Longwood Gardens, met with this man, Dr. Tsunoshige Rokujo. So he was an important plant collector. She went to go check out, well, she didn't go to go check out a rare plant, but she, that was part of like her trip. And she became pretty close friends with him. He was a rhododendron breeder, and they, that kind of started this collection idea that she had. So she inherited the farm eventually, which, and in her, I think in her 50s, she decided to create, I mean, I don't know if she's was, created an arboretum. So when she was in her 50s, she created the arboretum, and she started with, I mean, basically a seed. So she really had faith in seeds. She was very big into sharing, exchanging plants. She took botanical courses at the University of Delaware. She just continued receiving seeds, cuttings, planting things in the grounds, selected and named a bunch of different cultivars, and knew it was really, this is like very key. She knew it was very important, you know, from all her, the people she knew at Longwood, et cetera, that it was important to keep plant records. And so she actually had computerized plant records that were at that time in like the 80s, what a lot of arboretums used. So that really created kind of the backbone, I think, for Polly Hill Arboretum now. By the time she was in her 80s, she'd been working on this arboretum for like 30 years. It was private, but people knew about it. And she'd kind of, her children didn't want to take it on. So, she sort of resigned herself to selling it. And that's where David H. Smith came in. So he was a, he had actually developed a vaccine for spiral meningitis, and upon selling it, made money, but created the David Smith Foundation, which really advanced conservation goals. And he was very interested in conservation. He was a part-time island resident, very interested in the island community, but not really interested in horticulture. But someone had suggested you should meet Polly Hill. This, the land was 60 acres. It was kind of in this conservation corridor. And so he met with her. They got along really well. And then he learned about these plant records that she'd kept, essentially that she'd kept plant records from 1957 and almost every tree and shrub planted on the grounds. Pretty amazing for like a private endeavor. And so through that, he figured, she's a scientist like myself and was very interested. He bought the property. It became Polly Hill Arboretum Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit institution. David oversaw renovating like the homestead building. So there's different buildings on the campus that were all like, the homestead, the cow barn, which actually had cows, it was an old working sheep farm, essentially, a slaughterhouse, another barn. And so those buildings were renovated, a visitor center built, a parking lot, the hiring of staff, and it opened in 1998. And unfortunately, David Smith died from melanoma, but was like shortly after that, but did see the opening of the Arboretum, and it's been open to the public ever since. So over the years, it's grown a lot as an organization, both in terms of size of staff and plantings. New gardens have been added. There's been more renovations of buildings, a horticultural library, member library created. We tore down this old building called the gym, and it's now, we created the Education and Botany Lab, which has a world-class herbarium that houses specimens from Martha's Vineyard and Dukes County flora. And plus our like expedition collections and collections documentation, and are now kind of, we've bumped out our herbaceous plantings over the years, even though we're like really focused on trees and shrubs, and are also have more of a conservation focus.
It's really interesting to hear. I think a lot of Polly Hill parallels our history too, where it's just like a very independent, well-off person who is very passionate about something, keeps good records, and eventually gets to a point where they are like, okay, I have this amazing thing that I did and I don't want it to go away. What do I do with it? And so they were able to make it into something. And that's really amazing. And I'm glad it's still around. And it seems like you're doing really great work now.
Yeah, that really struck me, that the story of Holden Arboretum, which is where Connor and I work, is very similar, even down to the 90s being, the 80s, 90s, the time when it sort of came to be a public institution. The other thing I love about your story, this is the second time I've heard about a vaccine inventor being a rhododendron contributor in a big way. Ben Hall, who did a ton of work on the genomes of rhododendrons, was a vaccine inventor. So there's this weird, strange attractor of doctors to rhododendron. I still haven't figured it out, but you just added like another mystery piece to the puzzle. That's very cool. And a labor of love, to when someone does something for the joy of it for their life, and then we get to enjoy it as a society. What a gift. That's beautiful.
Yeah, truly.
So in addition to thinking about part of what's woven into your story is the Martha's Vineyard story and it being a unique place and a unique climate. And we're curious about the climate of Poly Hill Arboretum. Can you tell us how it's different from the rest of New England? And we hear there's some special soils and maybe other native ericaceous plants on the island.
Yeah, definitely. So in terms of climate, we're like a temperate maritime climate. So it's an island. It's moderated by the ocean, the climate is. We're zone 7A. So we can grow a little bit more things than say they may in Boston or even on the Cape, Cape Cod. So we have really late springs and extended falls. So the ocean is slow to warm up and also slow to cool down, like slower than the air, I guess is what I'm saying. So our winters are a little bit warmer than other places in New England, and our summers are a little bit cooler. So it doesn't get like quite as like hot, although it's been pretty, it was warm this summer, I'll be honest, and humid. But that's what has made it such a great vacation spot. And it's kind of, I guess, known as a vacation spot, although it's much more than that. We've got pretty blustery winds being on an island, especially like on those kind of outer edges. We're a little bit more protected. At Poly Hill is more inland. It's not like on the coast. But you know, a lot of the trees that you see at the Arboretum or a lot of the trees that you see on Martha's Vineyard have like a kind of gnarled, windswept look to them. They're generally shorter than a lot of trees you'd see on the mainland. Like I just went to the Pacific Northwest and just like the towering conifers, it was like so different. But in terms of soils, the Poly Hill or the island generally is sort of made up of two classes, moraines and outwash. So moraine being where the extent of the glacier, like the southern extent of glaciers. So those are like ridges and hills. So it gives Martha's Vineyard some topography. And then the outwash being when there was meltwater, all the sediment, sand, silt kind of ran down the glacier, and that's what created the outwash. So we've got very sandy soils. We also have very acidic soils, which makes it good for a lot of ericaceous plants, including rhododendrons. We also, at Poly Hill, there are some clay pockets. So we do grow, you know, there's some like wet areas and areas where it's like beetle bung. Well, we call them beetle bungs. You may know them as black gum, Nissus sylvatica grow. But we have, yeah, well-drained acidic soils. So one of those ericaceous plants do quite well on site. In terms of native ericaceous plants to the island, there's quite a few. We have one azalea, Rhododendron viscosum, swamp azalea, found in like the riparian areas, mostly along streams. The state flower of Massachusetts, the Mayflower, Pygia repens, grows on the island. We've got three different kinds of huckleberries, five different kinds of blueberries, a couple kalmias, the sheep laurel, Kalmia angustifolia, and mountain laurel, Kalmia latifolia, and cranberry, which is also something that's, you know, there's a lot of cranberry production on Cape Cod.
Sounds like a yummy place.
Yeah. it's very different. I came from I was just recently working in Kentucky. And so the sand plain grassland kind of, we also have like a pitch pine oak forest is what, like the kind of forest type of Martha's Vineyard. That's a little different than what I'm used to.
That's very cool. Yeah. Can the wind be problematic for your plantings? Do you have to take efforts to make protective wind blocks and things like that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. There's a there's an area in the Arboretum called Polly's Playpen, and it's this section that is completely fenced in for deer fencing. So there's like over like 50 deer per square mile on Martha's Vineyard. It's a lot of deer. We have a lot of deer pressure. It's hard to keep them out. We do deer spraying. But this playpen, it was where Polly had like, she put her most precious plants, and it was always, you know, fenced in to keep the deer out, essentially. And the conifer rose is right along the border of that. And then there's woodland on the other side. And those rows were planted partially for windbreaks to protect those precious plants that are in there. The conifer rows are pretty cool in and of themselves. So we do like have to take into consideration protection when we're deciding where we're going to put something.
Yeah. I come from the Southwest, which wind is a feature of the climate. And so I think people here in Northeast Ohio don't often appreciate how wind-free their environment is and what that means for what they can grow, because that drying effect of the wind, especially in the winter, it can be devastating. So that's conifer sounds like a beautiful solution to that problem.
Yeah, and we definitely get our the most wind in the winter too. Yeah.
Wow.
Very windy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And our experience when we do get wind, it's the shallow rooted plants just will just pop right out of the ground if you're not careful.
Whoops. Tree falls.
Well, you mentioned Polly's Playpen, and that I actually, I visited Polly Hill, for those of you who weren't there with me, over the summer, and I got to see Polly's playpen for the first time after hearing about it for a while. And we have lots of Polly Hill plants in our gardens here at Holden. But it's such a cool feature of the garden, to just have Polly's favorite plants, and special plants in what's called a playpen. And it sounds like Polly has been interested in rhododendrons and azaleas since the beginning. Is that true?
Yeah, very true. Our first accession, like rhododendron accession, is in 1959, which is like the year after the first accession ever. So really from the beginning, she was interested in rhododendrons. Part of that was, her Dr. Tsunoshinigi Rokujo, who was kind of a rhododendron breeder, being her friend and some of that influence. But we currently have like 543 active accession items of rhododendrons, and that includes seed that's come in that we're growing right now. And about 350 of those are just in our greenhouse and nursery, which is pretty crazy. We're definitely not going to be able to put all of those on the grounds. We have limited space. So Polly Hill is like 60 acres, 40 of which are actually preserved woodlands, and then 20 of which are cultivated. And we have very specific kind of instructions from Polly Hill herself, where, you know, this was a sheep farm and there are fields in the middle of the collections, and they're always to remain a field, because to keep like that, the idea that this was a sheep farm. So of the 81 plants that Polly actually introduced, selected and introduced, I think almost half of them are rhododendrons. It was pretty cool. You may have heard of the North Tisbury azaleas. Some of those are definitely evident still exist in the playpen. Those are some of her early selections. She received seed and cuttings from several different people, including Dr. Rokujo. And they're these semi-evergreen, low-growing rhododendrons that are, you know, between white, pink, and red colored. I can't remember exactly how many she introduced that are the North Tisbury azaleas, but quite a few.
I know we have a bunch of them here. And actually, when I was going through our collection, when I started my job, we have a bunch that are from, in our records, listed as Barnard's Inn Farm. And so I initially thought, oh, I we didn't get these from Polly Hill. They're her things, but we just didn't get them from her. But no, it turns out, and as you said earlier, that was what became Polly Hill Arboretum.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And like the Barnard's Inn, the building I'm in right now, my office building, was initially kind of like, you know, way in the early 1900s, a sort of inn. Like it was like the stopping place for people who were like going down the road on Martha's Vineyard. And when the butchers purchased it, they kept that name.
Okay, that's cool. It's fascinating to think of the lives of the buildings and the plants that have gone before and the people who have seen them. Just thinking about a random person stopping by and seeing a beautiful rhododendron walking around the garden, that is a delightful vision for me. How cool. You mentioned to me at one point that the building you're in was built in the 1600s. Is that?
Yeah.
That's very cool.
So the buildings, our office building, I think it was like around 1690. Some of the other buildings are more like 1800s.
Wow.
But very old. Glad that they were renovated.
Yeah. That has to be some of the oldest buildings in the Martha's Vineyard area, yes?
I think so. I'm not an authority on that, but that would make sense to me.
We'll stick to plants.
Yeah. I moved here almost a year ago, so okay. I'm still learning a lot.
Yeah.
About Ireland and about Polly Hill.
Yeah.
All the plants that are here. There's a lot.
Very cool. The next thing we were thinking about is, what do you guys have in your sights for the future for rhododendron and azalea collections? What are your future objectives and focus? You have a very small space. Connor, can you imagine if all of Holden Arboretum was just the Leech Research Station? I think that's the comparable size, right? 60 acres.
Yeah. In some ways, it might be better because Holden might be too big.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's when you have all of these plant ideas and you can only put them in a little space, that's challenging.
Yeah. So what are you guys doing? What are you going to focus on in your little beautiful space there?
Well, I can tell you a little bit historically of what we have focused on and then what we're moving towards. So, you know, I'd mentioned the North Tisbury azaleas. We don't just have the North Tisbury azaleas. We kind of have three different categories. So there's those low-growing ones. There's the deciduous azaleas. So we have quite a collection of deciduous azaleas, especially the section Pentanthera, and then broadleaved rhododendrons. And we, in the past, Tom Clark, who was the previous curator here at Polly Hill, or one of the previous curators, he was here for about 10 years. He had focused on southeastern United States azaleas, specifically rhododendron basiae. So he actually got a grant, I think, from the American Society, Azalea Society, to collect seed from rhododendron basiae in like South Carolina, Georgia, North Carolina area. And we have been, you know, although there's been a lot of like introductions in the past, we're focusing a little bit more on conservation, and our collections generally have a certain focus. So we focus on Martha's Vineyard native plants, and plants of the Atlantic coastal plain, southeastern United States, which is great for azaleas, and Japan, and like kind of temperate Asia, Eastern Asia, Japan, Korea, some China. So we're also, we hold in conjunction with Arnold Arboretum, the National Collection of Stewardia. And there are two native or to North America species of Stewardia, Stewardia malachodendron, Stewardia aveda. And so that is a big focus for us. We've done a few different trips over the last couple years to go collect seed and scout areas for the Stewardia, but in, you know, we often go to riparian areas in southeastern United States, and associated species are often rhododendron. So that's where, you know, in the, we've really kind of started focusing on that, and especially wild collected plants from the southeastern United States. Just recently, I went to the Pacific Northwest, so Southern Oregon, Northern California. It was actually on a conifer collecting trip. So we're focusing on conifers, but I ended up getting a few rhododendron species, rhododendron macrophyllum, the Pacific rhododendron, and occidentale, the Western rhododendron. So kind of branching out a little bit. But we're looking to be an affiliate of the Global Consortium for the Conservation of Rhododendrons. We're already part of the GCCO, which is the Global Consortium for the Conservation of Oaks. And hopefully we'll be working with Connor and the Holden Arboretum on rhododendron prunifolium in the future. So, you know, we really, over 30% of our collection now is not just rhododendron collection, but general collection of plants is wild collected. And we want to, you know, even increase those numbers, because that's one of the leading, or just a cause of concern, conservation of plant species. And so we try to, you know, keep things ornamental, but are definitely moving in that direction.
That's an important mission. And botanical gardens are filling that in a way that nobody else in the world is doing that. So I'm excited that that is a central focus now. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. It's super important work, and I think kind of flies under the radar in the conservation world in some ways, that people are so set on preserving wild spaces. And of course we need to preserve wild spaces, but it's very hard when most of that is privately owned. And so we have our public spaces, our public gardens, to at least back up a lot of these plants, rare plants, away from their native habitats.
So
when I visited Polly Hill, of course you talked about your Stewardia collection, and of course you have an amazing rhododendron collection. Can you talk about some of the other collections you have? I mean, I was amazed by the monkey puzzles. I mean, is that the furthest north growing monkey puzzles in the United States? Maybe.
I don't know if I have the answer to that, but it's possible. We do have monkey puzzle trees. We have a fairly significant Encheanthus collection that we're actually looking to expand and possibly make another national collection from the Plant Collections Network of Encheanthus. Those grow, another ericaceous plant that grows really well. We have pretty significant holly collection, as well as magnolias. Some of my, you know, I was a intern here in 2013, and I remember doing magnolia phenology for the flowers, and just a significant collection that was really, I don't know, it really made an impact on me learning about that.
Can you tell us a little more about your intern program? I didn't know you had one. It's a thing that I love. So let's pump it up and get you some more interest in your internship.
Yeah, definitely. So we have an intern program where we have two summer interns, and they're horticulture interns. So they'll come just for the summer months. It's usually for people who are, you know, in some kind of degree program where they have the summers off and can do an internship experience. They are housed currently at Hoft Farm, which is this farmhouse run by the Nature Conservancy that like has conservation related interns from all over the island, kind of living in this communal space. That's good because the housing crisis on Martha's Vineyard, as well as like in a lot of different areas around the United States, is pretty significant. So it's really great that we have that option for interns. We also have a curatorial internship. So that's what I went through when I was a an intern. It was actually the collections management internship, but that's a 9 month to a year internship. And that is more focused on plant records and curation, and has produced lots of people who've become curators in the public garden world, including myself back at Poly Hill Arboretum, which is very special to me. And this year we actually had a greenhouse intern also. I'm not sure if we'll continue that, but that was a really big help. And that was about a 6 month internship.
Wow. You know, when
the
we
internship...
have,
oh sorry.
Go ahead. That's okay.
I was going to say, it's, you know, you work with the grounds crew or you work with the curator, but there's usually definitely educational components, you know, field learning, but also, you know, maybe traveling to the Woody Plant Conference at Swarthmore College, going to different gardens, doing herbarium specimens, that sort of thing.
Whenever I have interns, the last question I have to answer for them is, what internship are they doing next? So
yes.
I'm going to be excited to tell people about this in the future. That's very cool. And we'll put a link to it on our webpage so that people who are interested can find it.
Yeah, that'd be great. We have the curatorial internship will probably be posted in December or so.
Awesome. Yeah. Perfect. Are rhododendrons and azaleas, are they featured in any aspect of your education program, or are they just part of the sort of the landscape?
I would say that they are part of their education program. So not that we like hold a class on rhododendrons and azaleas every year or something like that, but you know, they're a very significant collection at Poly Hill. And we grow a lot of them from seed. So part of that is that education piece is, or even like research, I guess, is just finding out what, you know, how they're best cultivated at Poly Hill. You know, we have a lot of rhododendron. I think I mentioned like 350 different plants in our nursery we have to get out, and we've been putting them out on the grounds. We'll often group plants together now to show it's sort of more like a passive educational experience, but plants that are all even from the same accession that have so much phenotypic diversity. So you'll see a very different flower color, and we'll purposely group them together and interpret that in tours and that sort of thing. And I would say that the other part of it is kind of what you described of just like they're everywhere. You know, I don't think it would be impossible to like walk through Poly Hill and not pass some kind of rhododendron. Yeah.
It's not typical these days for people in horticulture to have rhododendron specific training. So I think Connor's going to be looking in his job applicants to see if they've had a Poly Hill internship, because those are all the skills he wants his interns to come with.
Yeah, they're a real labor of love, that's for sure. And certain sites certainly make them easier than others. And it's a fun challenge to have, I think.
Yeah, I have a very we have a few like very large shrubs, like rhododendron maximum, like just giant shrubs that this year I looked across one of our fields and saw like three people on ladders just pruning to keep it just out of the path a little bit.
Wow. Happy plant.
Happy, very happy plant.
That's like our experience with them, is that they're like too big and uncontrollable, or they're just like suffering and waiting for someone to just end it for them. So you've talked a little bit about future or past work with rhododendrons and azaleas. Oftentimes they're just opportunistic collections because they grow everywhere, it seems. Mm-hmm. But do you have any future goals for your rhododendron azalea collection?
I mean, I'm just focused on getting more wild collected plants. And I don't have like a very specific focus yet, other than like wild collected conservation concern species. We have a new garden area called the Woodland Garden. It's like our collections expansion garden. So we have limited space here at Poly Hill. And that garden will, you know, we have existing trees because it wasn't in a woodland area. So different kinds of like nissas, black oak, white oak, American beeches that are kind of the canopy. But the idea is to have these sort of spring blooming woodland plants, which rhododendrons are going to be perfect for that, as well as Corallopsis, Hamamelis, this sort of thing. And so it's exciting for, well, all those plants that we already have in the nursery, but for, we'll actually have a place to put new species.
That's really cool. And so you have obviously a backlog in your nursery, but I think it's always, we always struggle with this too. It's, you also want to go get more. So do you have any, and you just got back from a trip, it sounds like. So what are your just trips in general? Do you have thoughts about upcoming?
Yeah. And, you know, during COVID, we had to, I wasn't here, I was somewhere else, but from that beginning piece of COVID, but we had to put a lot of trips on the back burner. And so that, like the trip I just went on for the Pacific Northwest, that was, you know, something that was going to be done maybe in 2020, and ended up being 2022. And have done quite a few trips to Florida, Georgia, planning on hopefully going back to the Southeastern United States, maybe next year, the year after, possibly even back to the Pacific Northwest, more like mid-California area, like not quite, a little bit farther south, and we were in very Northern California. Like, we wouldn't want to go too far south in California because that would not work very well here, but there's some areas we want to go back to, and then also hit Washington, like kind of southern, southern part of Washington state.
So Emily, one of the things I was just thinking about is the fact that our listeners, rhododendron fans, are often very focused on hybrids. I think I'm one of the weirdos who's really, really into species. And I think that maybe some people might not understand why it's important to do the wild collecting. What is the purpose? What are you gaining by going to, why go back to the Pacific Northwest and get seeds from another place, for example? Can you explain why that's an important aspect in conservation specifically?
Yeah, sure. So I can't remember which part of the global strategy for plant conservation or what number it is for a goal. It's like 16 or 7 or something, but is to have 75% of plants in an ex situ collection. So that means offsite from the area that they are growing naturally. And that's important because our natural lands are degrading and being developed. And even if we're like saving them, sometimes it's already too late. And so it's basically botanical gardens are serving as a backup for species. And to have, you know, one place where it's backed up is great, but to have more than one is even better, especially, and to have plants, you know, kind of backed up that are genetically diverse. And so in a way, botanical gardens then, you know, can be used for, to take cuttings and repopulate areas, or even seed if it's, you know, not hybridizing. So there's like seed orchards. Some gardens could even be considered a seed orchard if they're like really focusing on that. We call it conservation horticulture. And so I think that, did that make sense?
Yeah, it makes, I love conservation horticulture is a beautiful phrase. And I think we need more of that in our ethos of gardening, is that I often emphasize to rhododendron folks that they have that opportunity themselves in their home garden There's no reason they can't do conservation horticulture and learn from experts like Polly Hill how it's done. Please, random people don't collect seeds on private property or in the national forest without a permit. But it is it is something, or at a botanical garden. Please don't take our plants without asking. But I think that's a beautiful model for how we can all participate in conservation in our own little space and support gardens like Polly Hill that are making a big effort in that. That's really cool.
And it even seems like Polly Hill kind of like set an example, like, you know, she kept records, right? So the work that she did 60 years ago is still useful to you now because she wrote it all down. And she was just maybe not an average homeowner, but a homeowner or like a private property owner who was really just passionate about what she did.
Right. And that, you know, thinking about records, you know, when we go on these expeditions, it's not like we're just like taking plants and then coming back and putting them in the ground and mapping them. We're taking GPS coordinates from where they were collected, lots of information on the associated species and what the plants were like, exact localities, that sort of thing. So that's what like really enriches the living collection, living museum aspect of an arboretum botanical garden.
And those data, you can imagine in the future, if, you know, in discussing the idea that a botanical garden could be a source for restoring degraded areas, that ecological information is going to be just as valuable.
Exactly.
So do you have any new gardens projects? You talked a little bit already about some of them, but I think in regards to what should visitors be excited to see at Polly Hill in the near future?
Yeah, so I did mention the collections expansion garden, the new woodland garden. I mean, that's been in the works since I was an intern here 10 years ago. We're just starting to plant it now.
Yeah.
And not like plant all of it. Like it won't be open for a while. I want to make that clear.
Yeah.
But starting to get like, you know, anchor plants in and trees and shrubs. That's something that we're starting. So that's a really exciting and really exciting project for me. We also have, it's not really a garden, but you have 40 acres of preserved woodland. And we finally, it's always had these sort of utility roads and trails through it, but never been open to the public. And just this summer, very late summer, we opened the native tree trail. So we have native trees called out along the trail. That's about over a mile of trail. So it goes through really beautiful, like morainal, outwash woodlands, beach groves. It's really, really, really beautiful. And so that's really exciting and gives it like a different experience. So
that sounds like it's also worth a visit for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. We also have, this isn't really necessarily for the public, but it's an exciting project. We have a staff housing project going on where we've just started building two homes for staff housing, because the housing is very difficult to find on the vineyard. So we're hoping to attract talented individuals who want to work at Polly Hill and have a place to live.
That's neat. That's very forward thinking. You know, I think when you look at the field of horticulture, it sort of had withered a bit. And there's this extreme resurgence. Young people are so excited, and then they find out, oh, it doesn't pay a lot. And so having housing, like that's 90% of where your money goes. So that's a really big deal. I'm excited for you guys.
Yeah. And the around those houses will be a totally wild collected native landscape. So we're also collecting plants or seeds around Martha's Vineyard and growing them out for planting around that space.
How cool.
Something that's exciting that I sort of touched on, but we've for the, like a decade, have been working on a flora project, basically updating, documenting Dukes County flora, which is Martha's Vineyard and the Elizabeth Islands. And we just put, you know, a first draft sort of that's accessible on our website for the flora of Dukes County, which is really exciting. And all of those are vouchered in our herbarium. So hoping to do more herbarium tours as well, because it's like a really cool scientific part of the organization that I don't think that people necessarily think of maybe when they think of Poly Hill.
Do you invite scientific interest in your collections? Is that something you would host? Is someone coming to measure, you know, whatever the heck on a rhododendron?
Yeah, definitely. We, yes. The answer is yes, yes, yes.
And give us a call, in other words.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome.
You know, we have all these great records too. So that's, I mean, part of why, you know, doing research at botanical institutions and Arboretum Botanical Gardens is so, so cool.
Because you
can, they have good records. You can learn a lot. We've had in our preserved woodlands, the Harvard Forest has been doing a kind of ecological study for quite a while. So very open to research.
You know, it seems like botanical institutions are going one of two ways, amusement park or double down on let's do something good in the world and make sure that the public gets to enjoy the beauty of what that means. And I see that you're really focused on that, doing good and making sure that the public enjoys it in a way that reflects the value, and not just an empty consumption of entertainment. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's part of why I got into gardens or into botanical gardens specifically.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
Me three.
We're just a bunch of botanical garden nerds, and that's the way we like it. Connor, do you want to take on the last question, number 9?
So have you always been a botanical garden nerd, or did you grow into it?
I grew into it. I grew up really loving being outside. I basically grew up in the crab apple tree in our front yard, just climbing a tree. I like to tell a story of when I was really young trying to plant frozen lima beans to see if they could grow, which they did not.
How cute.
But, you know, I went to college at St. Olaf College in Minnesota. I'm from Minnesota originally, and they didn't have a horticulture program. I didn't actually know what horticulture was, but my senior year I took plant morphology and plant physiology and realized I liked plants. You know, I was a biology major, but I didn't know what to do with it. Graduated during the recession in 2009, and went to work for the Forest Service doing botany surveys in the East Cascades. And that kind of cemented just like, yeah, I want to work with plants. I don't know how though. And so I wanted to live in Maine because I love Maine. And there was a Maine Conservation Corps. There still is a Maine Conservation Corps, and they had a environmental educator position that was based out of coastal Maine botanical gardens. And that was the first time I'd ever been to a botanical garden. I worked helping open the children's garden and worked a little bit in horticulture, and just kind of spiraled from there. At the Arnold Arboretum, I went to Filoli in California, and you know, Poly Hill was actually a really big inspiration, I guess, when I got the curatorial internship here and spent 9 months here. It's where I like was like, I want to be a curator. It's like I figured that out. Like this, I really like this. Like I thought about going into library science, and it was almost this blend of like, oh, like plant records are kind of like being a plant librarian. That's cool. And I get to be outside and learn about plants. So, you know, that was what started, and it's why I went to grad school, and it's why I'm here now.
What's your graduate degree?
So I went to the University of Minnesota in applied plant science, and I got a minor in museum studies. And I focused on the conservation genetics of eastern hemlock, which is endangered in Minnesota. There used to be 5,000 trees in Minnesota, and then now there's less than 50.
Wow.
And so I studied disjunct populations and kind of comparing them to the main range genetically, and also looked into a little bit like of cuttings and seed propagation. And yeah, love eastern hemlock. Now I'm glad I get to. When I moved to Kentucky after that, and I was just like in Appalachia surrounded by eastern hemlock, and it was like a dream.
Nice.
Was that population decline pre-Adelgid or as a result?
Yeah,
of,
it was actually, sorry, I cut you off.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. It was actually due to a fire mostly and development. Oh, so there was a big fire started, I think because of a railroad, the Hinckley fire in the 1900s, that took out just like a large population. So it was always like sort of rare and disjunct, but it just dwindled after that. And so woolly adelgid hasn't actually hit Minnesota. And it's pretty cold there. So they really grow in like these very specific areas that are protected and moist. But hopefully hemlock woolly adelgid won't get there.
Yeah, it's we're starting to see a lot. Yeah, we're starting to see a bit of it now in Ohio, and it's like one of the things that I love about where I work is all the hemlocks. I mean, like the whole border of the property is hemlocks. I think a lot of them David Leitch brought from his house in Pennsylvania to here, and it just is like such a amazing part of the grounds. And it's just I'm so nervous about what their future is.
Yeah. Emily, interesting thing about your story that parallels, you know, when I work with students, they all say, I want to work with plants, but I don't know what. And you had this great experience where you were able to marry your interest in plants with your interest in library science. That is super fascinating to me. I view library science as one of the most flexible and cool and important career areas right now. If you had any advice to give to those young people out there saying, I don't know what to do, plants, what advice would you give to them on how do you get there to that place where you're really doing all the things that you find valuable in your work?
Well, I would say you have to try out things. You know, I did. Yeah. I remember calling myself a professional intern. It wasn't like great, but I mean, like I lived in like 5 different states. I did a lot of different internships. Sometimes it was hard, but you know, I was young and I had the means. I could do that. Not everyone can do that, but you know, to just try out different things. You know, I moved to California and I worked at Filoli, which is a very formal estate garden. And I, you know, got that experience. Realized I was really more into conservation and kind of went back to that. But I, you know, trying things out in different areas and even different parts of the world was really, really helpful for me. And maybe that the goal is to just not limit yourself to one thing.
Yeah. And one thing I hear you saying too, is people do need actually that to be able to have the support to have that exploration. I feel grateful that myself, I had a family that was very supportive of exploration and viewed that as a path. And I think there are people out there who don't have that privilege. And I think that's an important point you made, that I can see places that give internships and housing as looking to solve those problems and looking for how do we give people that ability to explore. And a lot of it is checking something off the list you didn't want to do. Check, don't want to do that. Try a new thing and don't get discouraged and just keep trying stuff. So the support to me, though, is key. Having that ability to do that. So that's cool.
For sure. Yeah. Well, I guess we should bring the conversation back to rhododendrons to end the podcast.
Yes.
But do you grow any rhododendrons in your personal life, in your at your home or on your windowsill maybe?
Well, it's interesting that we talk about, you know, housing, and the only reason I could move to Martha's Vineyard is that there's the curator's house at Polly Hill. And so I get housing through my job, which is very helpful to me. And it also means that I live basically at the Arboretum. So my backyard is rhododendrons. And the previous curator Tom, he had planted some around the house. I do plan on expanding the garden a little bit around the house, like, but we do have that like ability like to change that. But I can't say that I've, you know, I rented for so long. I didn't have a rhododendron bonsai or anything. And when I was in Kentucky, I'd bought a house, but I sold it a year later. So I didn't really get a chance to. So that's on the list. And with all those like rhododendrons that we have in our nursery, it would be like, I'd have to have a really good excuse not to plant some around.
You're going to have to be like, there's a spot with a sunbeam. Try that one out. I had the pleasure of living in an old home on the grounds of Holden Arboretum. And I can tell you, anyone who hasn't done that, which is the vast majority of people, it's a rare delight. I would walk out of my house and I would see a global flora that was lovingly created. I had a high bush blueberry behind my house. I would just go back there and eat the berries like a little bear. It was a delightful, it was a delight. I will never forget that time of my life. So cheers to you. What a beautiful joy to have that. Is that the same Tom Clark that is now at Exbury Gardens?
He's at Mount Holyoke. He's the director of Mount Holyoke Garden.
Interesting. There's two Tom Clarks in rhododendron world. Now I'm really intrigued. Mount Holyoke. I'm gonna look that up. Thank you.
Yeah. For sure.
Interesting.
He's also a Poly Hill Research Associate, so he came on the Pacific Northwest trip.
Awesome. I think we have another podcast interview to stock. Awesome. Well, it's been really fun talking to you, Emily, and learning about Poly Hill. It's on my list now to visit. So.
Yeah, it's been so great just talking plants with you all.
Awesome.
Yes, for sure.
Yep. Very cool. Yep. Well, hopefully I'm excited about the prunifolium conservation. Connor knows I'm kind of like freaked out, like excited about prunifolium, and we need it in our lives up here in the north because it blooms late and it's red. And what other choices do we have in late summer blooming red shrub? I don't think we have another one. So I'm excited.
Yeah. And just like it's amazing how many of those deciduous azaleas are perfectly hardy in cold places. So there's a lot of reasons to grow it.
Well, yeah. Emily, I hope you have a great rest of your day. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Yes, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for asking me. It was great.
Curious to learn more about the topics discussed in this episode? Visit our website at www.rhododendron.org. Here, you'll find tons of rhododendron resources, including tutorials, blogs, events, databases, and more. Click on the podcast link on the homepage to find more episodes, suggest a topic for a future episode, and get in-depth information about the people, places, and plants featured here. Until next time, keep carrying that torch for rhododendron. And don't forget to talk endlessly about this podcast to all your friends and family.